Welcome to Alchemical Dialogues, an Amber Light podcast. Join Dr. Henry Cretella and Leanne Byrne for their discussion on embodying your natural self. The information provided on this website and these podcasts is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this website and in these podcasts is intended to be a substitute for medical, health, therapeutic, diagnosis, or treatment. The opinions expressed by the guests in these podcasts are not necessarily the opinions of Amber Light International and anyone associated with this organization.
So welcome, everyone. Glad you could be here today. And welcome, Leanne. It's good to see you.
Oh, good to see you. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
Yeah, it's always fun talking with you, and I'm glad we could invite other people. So for people who don't know Leanne, Leanne is obviously a friend. And she's working in private practice as a social work therapist. She's always been interested in empowering people. That's something we've talked about on these podcasts in the past. She referenced that her spiritual journey began as a child when she would walk to church on her own when her family stayed at home. I love this. She considers herself, quote, a freelance spiritual pilgrim, end quote, which I think is great. And so over time, she recognized and developed and cherished her own natural uniqueness, her natural self, and found this to be central to happiness and self-acceptance and a sense of purpose. And she's writing on that. There's an unpublished book that we're going to encourage her to finish working on. The title, I believe, is Nourishing Your Natural Self, Embodying Who You Naturally Are in a Life That Is Truly Yours. Trained in Buffalo as a social worker, and she blends holistic and conventional approaches, especially working with people recovering from trauma and loss. So with that, Leanne, is there any place in particular you'd like to start?
Well, sure. I'll start with the general premise, which is that we are part of nature. And like all of the other creatures of nature on this planet, we are designed for some things more than others. And we are designed to fit in some places more than others. Palm trees, not for every place. Ponderosa pines, not for every place. And also for some places. And where they are suited for is the place where they are most likely to flourish. And so human beings are the most complex species on the planet. And therefore, we have perhaps a little extra challenge sometimes in determining just what is natural to us. And from my perspective, we have been designed by nature. Some of us might think of God or the universe or some other spiritual source that created the natural world on this planet of which humans are a part. And in so doing, nature created each one of us mindfully and with an intention that we would fit into the complex garden of life in certain types of ways and has equipped us to do so. So my thought is that when we are being who we were naturally are, who we were naturally designed to be, that's when we will be our happiest. And we can also be really confident that regardless of how simple, grand, or somewhere in between we perceive that design to be, we are fulfilling the purpose we were made for.
Are you talking about the collective we or each individual?
Right now, I mean our individual self. That if we are living a life that is consistent with who the truth of who we are, that we can be confident that we are fulfilling our purpose. I hear people often questioning whether their life has purpose or if they've done enough or if they are enough. And one of my key messages for folks is that we are always enough to be who we are designed to be. How could we not be? And I remember sitting in a yoga class years ago and the teacher saying in a meditative moment, "You are enough." And my body just went like, oh, because I'm not sure anyone had ever told me that I was enough. I'd heard plenty of messages about how I could be better or different, or that the ideal person looked like this or that, and I didn't always match up with that. I don't think anyone had ever told me that I was enough. And that is a central message embedded in a perspective of we're part of nature, part of the most complex species, and therefore designed for certain things and not others. And we don't need to be who we're not. Our only request from creation is to be who creation designed us to be.
So how do you think we got off track?
Well, you know, culture can be a double-edged sword. It is part of our humanity. It's embedded in human life. And at the same time, it forms us, but it can also sometimes restrict us and send messages that are counter to who we naturally are. So, of course, the culture I best know is that of the United States of America, because it's where I've always lived. And so I use that as a reference point, not to pick on our country specifically, but just because it's the culture I can most speak to. So, for example, the personality and the culture of the United States of America is very outgoing. It's very engaged. It's very busy. It connects everywhere and wants a lot of attention on itself and garners a lot of attention because of its big personality in the world. And so there are a lot of messages, even in our advertisement, among peer groups at times, just from our schools, the sort of like the ideal human being is also that. And one of the things that I have come to really appreciate both personally and professionally is the concept of where we fall on the introvert to extrovert continuum, which is a continuum and has nothing to do with being shy, but has everything to do with how we get our energy, how we fuel our personal fuel tank. And so the United States of America with an extroverted personality sends us a message that that's the ideal person. Extroverts fuel their tanks through activity and a lot of interaction with other people. Introverts are the reverse, where they refuel with quiet time. Maybe there might be, you know, one or two other very intimate people around them, but they really seriously need their downtime. And then there are some of us who are in the middle of that spectrum called ambiverts. I am one of those who need a certain mixture. And I've come to appreciate that even within ambiverts or within extroverts or within introverts, there's still range because, again, it's a continuum. And so just even that one thing vastly informs our level of satisfaction in life, because I used to, like other people, having been trained into an extrovert ideal, try to be one. I was exhausted and unhappy all the time because my fuel tank wasn't properly fueled and because I was trying to be somebody I wasn't. So I think when people feel unsatisfied in life, how you get your energy and whether you're trying to be somebody you're not or fit into an externalized mold that doesn't reflect who you are is an important beginning question.
I hear what you're saying, and I tend to agree with that. What's striking me is you really emphasize how being ourselves is natural.
Yes.
And my experience is, like yours, it was really hard for me to find my natural self. I'm still not sure that I found it. And we've had other podcasts where we talked about education. I think one of the major disservices we're doing with kids is not allowing them to be their natural selves as they grow, to explore and find out what that is. We're forever trying to tell kids what they should be, what career they should go into, what careers are better than others. And you're nodding your head, just for those who are just listening to the audio. So I'm really struck with, you would think, if you believe in the creator, that if we're created with something so natural, it would be natural to have a design embedded in us so that could be actuated.
Yes. And, you know, and I think there's like a perpetuating problem when we don't, as a society or an individual or a family or a spiritual group, wherever we might be referencing, when we are not referencing a central value of that for people to be who they are is essential to life itself, then we are setting all of us up for some dis-ease with the truth of who we are. And that creates unhappiness. It creates distortions that we don't need to have. But this is not yet, I'm hopeful that will change, but this is not yet how most of us have been taught to centrally source our choices, our decisions, and our interactions and perceptions of other people. Because this is also a perspective that encourages acceptance and non-judgment regarding other people. Now, we're not talking about accepting boundary violations or thinking, well, if this person's really behaving badly, that's just who they naturally are. This isn't permission to behave, for any of us to behave badly or be a jerk. It is an invitation to your highest, best version of who you naturally are, who I refer to as your natural self. Regarding children, when I there's a chapter in my book about children and encouraging a shift in perspective about how we raise our children. And there's this quote I found that I just love that I think says it all. And it says, children are not things to be molded, but are people to be unfolded. And it's by a person named Jess Lair, L-A-I-R. And I thought, there we have it. And in fact, I think I start that book chapter and say, well, there we have it. And probably I don't need to say anything more, really. And this is also, if we make this shift about how we raise our children, and if we make this shift regarding how we interact with ourselves, then we are, from my perspective, much on a path of happiness. And when all, you know, the part of the approach that we hear, particularly in spiritual circles, more and more about it, that is focusing on the self, as we sometimes are feeling overwhelmed with all of the dynamics in the world that are going on and seem so much bigger than us, that as we do our own work and foster our own happiness and foster our own light, that is a powerful form of participation in what's happening in the world. Because if we're all doing that, the world will become a different place. And if enough of us do it, then we become models for other people to do that.
So I agree with you, and I like that, but I don't want to shy away from, I mean, it's like, you were reading my mind. I was going to ask you about, I'm sure there would be questions about, well, how about those boundary violations or those terrible things that people do? And I had several thoughts. It's really hard. There's a Buddhist teacher who I never met in person, but he was a theosophist and he was a mentor to one of my Sufi teachers. And he said, joy is the natural state. And the Dalai Lama has said that. And I think that's really hard for people to believe, that the natural state of a human being is to be happy. And even more than that, there's some really fascinating sociological work that really has meant a lot to me. And it had to do with intrinsic motivation. And so in the time that I was raised, unfortunately, in psychiatry, behavior modification started to take off, and everything was being looked at from a behavioral viewpoint with reinforcers and punishments and all of this stuff. And I always felt uncomfortable with that. And I can see a limited application, but it really mushroomed. So every school I ever consulted with had kids on behavior programs. And so when I was reviewing this work on intrinsic motivation, the research is that left to their own devices, or to use your term, if you just let people be natural, they work. They love working. they don't want not to work. The essential ingredients, this came from a book called Drive, by the way, by Daniel Pink, which is one of the best, most readable books. I really like the way he designed it. Anyways, you needed three elements. Autonomy, you're working on something that you feel like you could work on forever and still not have a sense of mastery. And you're working for something greater than your own interest. And then I reviewed from some sociological work that added a few other elements. You're part of a group where you have status. You don't have to be the big shot, but you know you're a valued member of this group, that within that group, you have connections, you can reach out to people like you and I reach out to each other, and that there's a sense of fairness. So you have those elements. And what I learned from that, and then I looked at my own life and I said, without thinking about it, that's what I designed. And yes, I was a lot happier and I have a ton of motivation, right? That's the natural state, to be happy doing something you love. And positive psychology, one of my other favorite fields nowadays, but Martin Seligman, he talks about we each have signature strengths, defined as things we could keep on doing forever. We just want to do it all the time. You and I love to talk about this stuff.
That's what I mean by the natural self, signature strengths. Yeah, that would be right. Another term for it. Absolutely.
And if you can arrange your life to exercise those 24/7, you wind up having a pleasurable, meaningful, productive life.
Yes.
And these are all natural, these are natural qualities. And instead, somehow we've bought into this idea, well, you know, if you don't force people, they're not going to work. If you don't punish them for taking a day off, they're going to take advantage of that. If you don't make them fill out tons of paperwork and really get on their case when they need help and they have to go on some sort of welfare because they've had some bad luck, well, they're never going to come off welfare. All of that, I think, is antithetical to what the research is actually showing and to what I think you and I are saying. But it persists.
One thing I want to jump in about is saying when you're talking about like people will want to work, I think in a more detailed version of who we are, people want to do naturally. They want to, if left to their own devices, they want to do what they want to do. And for some people, that might be that they are born to have children and be a parent, for example, and maybe stay home with those children or provide daycare to other people's children or be involved in things that don't necessarily reflect competitive employment. So I just want to, if anyone is thinking strictly in those terms, want to broaden that perspective. Or some people who struggle once they retire with a sense of meaning, who were very connected to their work and what they did for competitive employment, is to point out that part of all of our purpose is around those connections. That book you were citing that referenced the need for connection, part of our purpose is to provide ordinary human connection to certain other people who become kind of in our pod, who, you know, who are the peoples who's in our corner of the immense garden of life that we connect with and intersect with. Like you and I are that for each other, Henry, you know, as well as other people. And that's part of our purpose. You know, one night a month or so ago, I called Henry and Kathleen when I was having a bit of a meltdown over something I'd heard that day and just was having trouble processing. And part of the purpose of their life at that moment was to help me with that. And when they helped me with that, that got me in a better spot that I could be more available to other people who don't know Henry and Kathleen at all. And those sorts of simple linkages are also important aspects of our life, the simple everyday things that we do for one another. And again, there'll be variations depending on who we are, what forms those take. I'm not the gal who's going to make the casserole and take it to somebody's house who's experienced a loss. I'm not a cook, but I'm probably the person who can go and sit with them and talk about how they're feeling, because that's more natural to me. So I just want to really expand that concept of work to be really more like how we use ourselves in the world and where we use ourselves in the world. One of the other things that I did want to talk about when you say, like, you know, those barriers, Henry, you know, like how we get off kilter with that, I want to touch briefly on the impact of trauma. Besides cultural pressures and socialization, trauma can be an enormous obstacle to expressing who we naturally are. So if something really nasty or a series of nastinesses have happened in our life, that can serve as a serious distortion to who we are in a variety of ways. Some can be in terms of like triggers or ways that people might overreact or kind of maybe end up appearing as if they're behaving badly when they're really in a state of uncontrolled reaction because something has reminded them of some sort of stored trauma. Or there's also what I refer to as the wet blanket effect of trauma, where it just dims everything in life and in a pervasive across the board way. So working on one's trauma is also an important aspect of unleashing, if you will, one's natural self, of nourishing your natural self, because those things can be heavy barriers indeed. You know, I have a young client who I'm immensely impressed with, who way earlier than most people has recognized how her huge history of trauma is interfering with her daily reactions and therefore interfering with her enjoying her life and being who she knows she is. And so she's rolling up her sleeves to work on that. And if we're not sure about that, that's a conversation you could have with Henry or a trusted friend or your family doctor or any number of people. Sometimes we don't even recognize that certain experiences we've had were traumatic and stored as trauma in the mind-body complex.
Corollary to that too, though, which is, so I want people to understand I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying or trying to downplay the effects of trauma, but there's also a labeling effect. So as a physician, and especially consulting in schools, I was told quite a bit how dangerous it was when you label kids. So kids are labeled as having attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and that label follows them through and causes teachers to look at them a certain way, and all of those effects that you can get from stereotypes and labeling, which isn't the purpose of making a diagnosis, but that's a side effect that has to be taken seriously. The culture, two things. One is it doesn't recognize trauma. At the same time, it overplays trauma. So in the American culture, it's like having a split personality because both of those things happen. People are exposed to enormous stress, and Americans are supposed to pull themselves up by the bootstraps and you have to keep on going. At the same time, talk about labeling. You know, people feel like something has happened to them and they're entitled to. They're so traumatized, they expect to be treated a certain way. They expect to be suffering for most of their lives. And as therapists, we sometimes have hopefully inadvertently played into that. To me, this connects to what your thesis is about being natural. We're all unique. We handle things differently. All things can be true. A trauma to me might not have the same effect as the same so-called trauma to you.
Oh, absolutely.
Right. In psychiatry, we were really curious about so-called resiliency. This person was exposed to this horrible trauma, and they didn't just survive. They're actually functioning well. And, well, they must be suppressing it and repressing it, and eventually it's going to come out. Well, it doesn't. And, you know, so there's some serious work being done about what makes certain people resilient. Is it genetic? Is it cultural? Is it their support system? You're saying everybody is unique in their own way. They have a natural way of being that includes how they respond to trauma. And anytime we start to predict, oh, if this, then that's going to happen. No, you're taking the person out of the equation, the natural person out of the equation.
Yes. I'm trained in a trauma therapy called EMDR, and EMDR talks about small T traumas and big T traumas. And then again, there is a range, there's a continuum, if you will, of the size of traumas. And to a certain extent, we can have some different perspectives about what size a specific sort of trauma is or isn't. And depending on who we are and how resilient we are and our resources, connections, a whole slew of variables can impact. For example, if two people are in the same car accident, one might have experienced long-term trauma from that and the other may not. I also think that there are some things that if you experience them, you have trauma. Things like sexual abuse, childhood physical abuse repetitively, particularly, things like that, that if somehow, while you might not be walking around necessarily overtly bleeding the outcome of that, there is still some sort of way that those universally big T traumas, things that we can pretty much all agree are big traumas, have in some way worked against the fullest expression of your natural self and are worth taking a look at, particularly if you are struggling with feeling happy, content in life, or satisfied, or really being confident that being who you are is enough.
Well put. We had a comment I wanted to get to before we go on much further.
Sure.
When we were talking about, you know, we have a natural tendency to be happy, to want to work, be productive. Comment is that part of the notion that we have to force people persists because of our Judeo-Christian ethic, seeing us as sinners in need of perfection, usually from somebody else's point of view.
Right.
Right. You're the one who needs to get perfected.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, any comments about that?
I think that one of the things that I often end up talking about in one context or another with my clients is that we, and I'm using this very broadly, human beings are being impacted by our human history. And many of, in my sense about this, my take, which may or may not be accurate, but my take is that some of this stuff comes out of the fact that for the vast majority of human existence, we have needed to be very worried about literal survival. And so a lot of hard and fast rules came into play to help people stay focused on survival. And I think that some of that comes through certain spiritual practices or things like this comment was referring to, that comes through things like our values about marriage. I was just having a conversation with someone about yesterday about this, where, you know, the till death do us part standard came through at a time. I once heard that marriage was invented when the average life expectancy was 28. Well, you know, not such a terribly long time to have to hang in with somebody. Whole different deal when we live until we're 70, 80, or 90. If that is a relationship that is not nurturing to our natural self and we can't find a way to shift it into that. And the same thing, I think, with things about our Puritan work ethic sorts of experiences, that a lot of that comes out of a fairly recent history that if we don't do it this way, people die. And that is no longer true for us, at least not most of us in this country. It might still be true in some parts of the world, but for most of us participating today and listening to this podcast, if we have the luxury to listen to a podcast, we are probably not in that position. But we still may be being influenced by standards and values that came out of that long period of human history, that even in this country, we could argue the point, but in this country even only ended perhaps in the last 90 to 100 and 110 years. The Great Depression was less than 100 years ago when most Americans were living in this condition of survival. We are sort of the pilgrims in human history to maybe move out of these hard and fast rules that, again, from my perspective, came out of the need to emphasize survival and update them to a place of thriving, which is where we are now transitioning into. We have the opportunity to transition into.
Good point. I think we have trouble with rules, because that's getting back to what we touched on earlier when you said, you know, we're not talking about boundary violations, or this is not an excuse to let your worst impulses run free.
Right.
So one, I'm sure there are some people who would argue and say, like Freud said, you know, people can be so destructive, there has to be an instinct in them to do that. And I'm not sure I agree with that. But that's a debate, that everybody has instincts, they have impulses. Some of those, it's better for us collectively and individually if we learn to control them. I think there's truth to that. To do that, if I understand you correctly, not just survival, but survival in the sense of being able to be together, to have a relationship and to be together, or to raise kids, or to be able to hunt or grow food, et cetera, you need to control certain things and you need to work together. There's a line somewhere though. So you mentioned spirituality, you know, the idea that you have to have this belief. So I grew up Roman Catholic, and I was taught as a child and as an adult, because I went to a Catholic college as well, that if you don't have this belief, then there's an afterlife and you're eternally damned.
Right. Me too. Not Catholic, but same message.
Right. Okay. Some people will believe that. I no longer believe that. But even that puts a barrier. The religions I've been exposed to, there are a whole lot of barriers. And some of them are subtle, and some of them are pretty firm. You know, there's only one way you can interpret scripture. Well, Martin Luther threw that on its head, and then he got scared because he couldn't believe some of the interpretations people were making. So then they were trying to reel that back in. So I think what I'm getting to is I think we have a fear about being natural, and we've imposed some guidelines which have become, in some circumstances, more hard, fast rules that I'm not sure need to be there, and that I think are getting in the way of our being able to be comfortable with even finding our natural selves, never mind expressing it. But there's also a line that says, yeah, but there needs to be some collective agreement that certain things are done in a certain way for us to be able to get along. And it's more than just survival.
Yeah, the tension between the individual and the collective. And I don't have all of the answers for the paradoxes and dilemmas of being human, that's for sure. I frequently say that the human design plan is one of imperfection, or put the reverse way, perfection is not part of the human design plan. And that's one of our challenges, is to deal with those imperfections. It is also, though, where I would like to point out much of our connection occurs, is around the fact that we cannot do it all. And so we need one another. My very life is dependent on a whole bunch of strangers who get heat and electricity to my home in Montana winters, who provide food, incredibly complex system that gets food to the grocery store where I can go in and buy it, because I'm not in a position to produce all my own food, except, and we all are at this point, and just around basic things before we even get to things like emotional and social support and spiritual nurture, we need one another. And so how we maintain our connection to our natural self, I think in that context, is to really appreciate the fact that, well, I see it as a fact, that we were designed by nature, universe, God, however we think about it, who fit into certain niches in among the most complex species on the planet with the most complex society and system of survival. And we can trust that if we are doing that, we are fulfilling our purpose, repeating something I really said in the beginning. But also, there is a component that has to do with our appreciating one another's differences at the same time and learning how to not expect perfection in one another and how to really nurture and draw on the strengths of the people around us. That night I referred to that I was feeling very distressed about something that occurred in my day. I very specifically chose to call Henry and Kathleen because they were the people who were the best match for what I was struggling with that day.
So what? How do we do this?
Oh, how do we do this? Yes. Okay. So I have some bullet point tips. So one thing is that I think I often hear people say that they don't know who they are. And that may or may not be true for anyone who's sitting here. They may or may not feel that way. I think it's also relevant, though, to any gap we feel that we might have between where we're at right now and living from the truth of who we naturally are in a life that is truly ours, and knowing we are enough to do that, that you start with what you already know. So when somebody says to me, I don't know who I am, I literally give them the assignment to sit down, take a very good sit down, and write out everything they know about who they are, no matter how small, medium, or large they think that might be. Like, I know I don't like to cook. I've already referenced that earlier, right? I also know I can cook adequately, but I don't love it. I have a friend who's a chef. We always joke about this. You know, we're very different in this guy. It's not what makes my heart sing. It is what makes his heart sing, right? So that immediately, just this one point, makes he and I very different people who fit in different niches of life. And so start with everything that you know about yourself. And I just want to say further, what you know to be true, not what you think should be, or even not what you wish was. Like, I wish I was funnier than I am. And I can be funny, but I wish I was funnier on average. But it's not the truth of who I am. So I'm not going to write that down, that I'm a funny person, because I can be funny would be a more accurate statement, right? Of who I am. So it's writing out the truth of what you know about yourself, and then going back and adding in things as they pop in your mind, because no sit down is going to cover every single thing. And then ground yourself in what you already know. I also think that it is very useful to allowing more of the truth of who you are to emerge if you cultivate the practice of treating yourself as if you were a dear friend, because you are. Your relationship with yourself is the only relationship you are in 24 hours a day until the moment you die. The only one. How is that relationship? This is the most important relationship for any of us to cultivate. And so, do you tell yourself inside your mind the things you would say out loud to a beloved person? Do you treat yourself with the same gentleness you would want to treat a small child or a dear friend with? Do you allow yourself to be who you are in the way that you would hope to allow another person to be? So cultivating that relationship with yourself as a dear friend gives you the space and the wavelength to honestly tune in to who you are and who you are not. I also think it's important to practice trusting your natural design. You know, like think about the things that we've talked about here today, the things that I've said, and say, well, what if that woman is correct? And that just being who I am is enough. Could I just practice that sense of trusting that creation, however you experience creation, knew what the heck it was doing when it made you the way you naturally are? And that if you can nurture that mindset within you, that becomes a really important piece, a foundation to pursuing your natural self and a life that is truly yours, and knowing that you're enough. Sometimes it is fun to recall what you knew when you were a child and what you enjoyed when you were a child. Most of us were a bit more unfettered when we were children. And some of us were very burdened as children, but still there may be aspects of ourselves that when we look back, we can bring forward again. For example, just a simple example is some years ago, I was like, I need a new recreational activity. And what did I used to like to do that I don't like to do anymore? Well, one of my favorite gym activities as a kid was archery. So I thought, I'll try archery again. Guess what? I still like archery. Right? So things like that, we can kind of bring back from an age when maybe we had been less impacted by life and its expectations and its standards and the Puritan work ethic, or et cetera, et cetera. One of the things I have recognized about myself, just so when you said, I said Puritan work ethic, bop back in my mind, for example, is the truth of the matter is, I only really want to work kind of at a moderate level. I do not want to work hard. That would have to go on my list and of what I know about myself. And I had to say that I do have to allow myself to step outside of everybody else's expectations and update them for myself. Right. And that we all need boundaries. We all need values. We all need beliefs, and to be healthy human beings. Without those things, we're just kind of a mess of blah, you know, it's not a pretty picture. However, we get to update all of that as we live and as we learn more about ourselves and as we go through developmental stages, and we are always in a developmental stage at any moment in life. Okay. I can see that most of us are more mature people and we are also in a developmental stage. I have clients who are in their 60s and 70s confronting how are they going to negotiate this stage of life. And one of the reference points I always use is that no matter what you're confronting in life, what changes might be occurring or challenges that are happening, to do that from the place of who you are is going to be your best position. And don't go it alone. This is one of my other tips. Use those connections. Know that you have companions. Sometimes asking people for feedback when we are a little unsure or have lost a little track or connection with who we are, asking for the feedback of trusted people. Years ago, I asked a minister what I thought was the million-dollar question. How do you know when God is speaking to you? And he did not hesitate, and he popped out three things, only one of which I remember, unfortunately. I guess it was the one that meant the most to me, and it also still fits with where I'm at now, which was when there is consistency between the people who know you the best and are most connected to you are saying.
A good point.
And this is also a way sometimes to begin to understand who we are, is when you repetitively hear people who know you give you feedback and say, well, you know, this is you or this is not you, or, and that is a way to understand who you are. I write about this in the book, that years ago, in my work settings, I would fairly often have someone tell me, you have a way with words. And I would be dumbfounded, because I know every single time that I have stumbled over my words or not said something as well as I wanted to. There have been several of those in this time today, you know. And so in my internal world, which was also at that point, I was not in a place of treating myself like a dear friend. All of this conspired that I didn't recognize something that is true of me. And one day I literally said to myself, well, these are people I know and respect. They can't all be wrong. And so I started to open up to the possibility that maybe this was true of me, even though I don't do it with perfection. And you know, and after all, I make my living by talking, pretty, you know, I mean, applying a skill set and what have you too, but right. And so there are things like this, perhaps about you, that you can also tune into from what, you know, what do other people consistently reflect to you about yourself?
I agree with you. But I had this experience once. I was in an organization and I joined it in part because I was in a spiritual group that we decided we wanted to be part of this. And so the group would have interviews just to get to know you. And so it was the organizer who was interviewing me over lunch. It was kind of random. And this person wasn't a trained mental health worker, as far as I know. And we were talking and I was kind of running through different things that I had been in. And for some reason, I must have been feeling badly that I hadn't stayed with certain things as long as I thought I should. But I was kind of like, he was just asking me different things that I had done and been involved in. And all of a sudden, he says, with a lot of energy, like he made a discovery, oh, you're a change agent. And I said, what? You get in, you change things, or things change because you get involved, and then you get out. And I said, yeah, but I'm supposed to stay. And he said, no. Change agents don't stay. They go in, they do something, and then they leave. Other people stay. And I've been thinking about this for years. And there are things that I have been in for years. I've had friendships that go on for a long time. I teach classes that are kind of known for my consistency, and I never miss, and they've gone on for years and years. And I was a psychiatrist for 30 or 40 years, even though within that, I kept changing what I was doing, but I stayed at one place for 17 years. You know, I have that in me. But I've also been in situations and in relationships where I stayed because I thought I should, but I stayed too long. And then I would always wonder, why did it take that much before you got out? You know, whether it was a work situation or certain relationships. That one comment from him made me rethink and gave me permission to see myself in a different light. And by him saying, there's a label for that, that's you. And by the way, it's okay. There are people that's what they naturally do.
Yes.
That was one person.
Yes.
It wasn't 10 of my friends, right?
Yes. Brilliant example.
But yeah, boy, was it timed correct. And it really helped. It still helps. And now I see, well, I haven't figured out when am I a change agent and when do I stay? Because sometimes I've done both successfully and I feel good about them. There's something that I can't quite predict. But I have both of those in me. And I have to admit, I get bored. I like things changing. And if you tell me this is the way it is and it's going to stay this way, I'll probably argue with you right then, because that just doesn't seem natural to me.
Well, it's not natural to you, right? Yeah. And here's something else about your story that I just want to point out. Besides, it's illustrating the point. And I said consistency over multiple people, but yes, sometimes it can be that one person. And here's the other side of this story that I think is important for all of us to recognize when we think about our own place in the world and the value of our life and et cetera, is that man changed your life in a way. He helped you see yourself. He helped your level of self-acceptance increase. He helped you become more mindful of how you use yourself in the world. He probably does not know that. And he was being who he was and doing what he was good at in that moment. And in doing so, in that one sentence, profoundly impacted you.
Yeah.
And we all do that for one another sometimes. And most of the time we don't know it, but this is part of what I like to emphasize to folks too, that aspect of just being our ordinary self, doing and saying our ordinary things is profoundly important in the course of our life and in the course of other people's lives.
Right. Just to finish the story, he left the organization and within months I left after him.
That was kind time of for change.
I couldn't take it anymore. He couldn't take it anymore. You know, I thought, did I leave because he left? Yes and no. I would have left anyways, but I really hit it off with him. And when he said, this just isn't me, he entirely changed his career. He said, this isn't me. I have to go do something entirely different. And I was saying, but I like you and actually like what you're doing. And if you leave, I don't like the rest of the organization, so there's nothing here for me. And so that was a funny outcome. But it was almost, again, I think I would have left anyways, but he modeled for me, this just isn't me anymore. Because we talked about things like, well, you feel you're not being treated well. And he said, no, I just don't feel like I'm doing a good enough job. So then I got into, why are you being so hard on yourself? What finally came out is, I thought this is something I want to do, but I'm paraphrasing, it just isn't for me anymore. And he left. And I think that just was another model for me about, well, yeah, why do you stay with something when you don't want to stay with it anymore?
Right. And doing that from someone else's standard, again, that may have grown out of a whole different period of time in human development,
right,
just would diminish you and your life. So one of the tasks for all of us is to allow ourselves to update. I touched on this very briefly as a bullet point sort of comment, to update our beliefs and our perceptions about ourselves, about life, about other people. I once did an hour and a half presentation on beliefs. And I started, before I said anything beyond my name, I started by asking who in this room believes exactly what they believe. A year ago, nobody. 6 months ago, nobody. 3 months, nobody. 2 months, nobody. 1 month, nobody. I got down to a week and no one had raised their hand. Even I was surprised at that point. And we tend to have this tendency to have sort of an iron grip on whatever it is that we believe about in a particular moment. I think we are better served to remember that we are eternal students of life and to hold our perceptions and our beliefs and our guidelines with somewhat of an open hand. Hold them because we need them, but hold them with a bit of an open hand, and so that we are willing to grow and update them as we learn more about ourselves, as we learn more about life, as we have more experiences, and that helps us stay happier folks.
So we've covered something about being okay with ourselves and our natural states and strengths and weaknesses, some points about how to get there. And I want to get back to the boundaries. So we've kind of said, okay, this doesn't give us free rein to be jerks, to use your word. And there are some guidelines if we want to be together with people, which we have to be, and most of us want to be, some guidelines about, okay, we have to kind of help each other and be able to do certain things to be able to be together. So what's your perspective on where do you draw these lines so that we can still be our natural selves and still have some agreement that to be together in this unit, whether family, spiritual, work, your city, your neighborhood, whatever, that, yeah, it's okay to have some expectations and maybe, there's some things that don't seem natural to me, but yeah, it's something I have to do and it's okay to do that.
So I encourage a reference point of examining your boundaries and often your choices and how you interact with situations as well from a perspective of what is self-honoring. And that is not a static answer. So what is self-honoring varies depending on an enormous numbers of details in a particular moment. So if a friend asks me to help them move this weekend, whether that is a self-honoring choice or not depends on enormous numbers of variables. It depends on my physical condition, whether or not I have other commitments, whether or not I'm in the midst of a personal emotional crisis of some sort. It may have to do with that perhaps this person has helped me move 5 times and I've never helped them move, or vice versa, right? And various other details that I can't answer or that I can't identify right now. And so, if there's an expectation in a family that we all gather every Sunday for dinner at 1 and nobody is to ever miss it, I would say the same thing. Is that a self-honoring choice for you? It might be, because it might be that your sense of connection, importance, and enjoyment, and you honestly like doing this. And so you're generally going to be there on Sundays at 1, but can you also simultaneously allow yourself some space that if on a particular Sunday something really important to you is going on, that you might say, sorry, I know I'm usually there, but I'm just not going to be there this Sunday. And if somebody else has a crisis because you're not going to be there this Sunday, that you don't take on their crisis as your crisis. That would be a boundary. That if they're that upset that, one time you're going to bow out of Sunday, that is something for them to work with within themselves. And you cannot do their work. You can only live your life in as a respectful manner as possible, which, and being self-honoring, if you really lean into honoring, you are not going to mindlessly, rudely prod over the rest of the world, because that's not self-honoring to do that. And so also how we express our self-honoring choices to other people when we are coming from that place will tend to be assertive, yet gentle enough, and be delivered in a respectful manner. Now, once again, other people may or may not hear it that way depending on where they are at personally or how they differ from us, but then that's the best we can do. And is to express what will be our boundary in a particular set of circumstances that we have sourced from a place of referencing what self-honoring, which has embedded in it our connections with other people.
That's a really interesting way of putting it. I love that. Thank you very much. There were two instances. One of the best compliments I had, I was at a meeting that was going on for days and days, and there were some tough interchanges. And somebody I didn't know, they were sitting ahead of me at the end of the meeting, and we were going to go to lunch just before we had to catch how we were going to leave the city. And the person turned to me and said, I like you. You're assertive and not objectionable.
And it's like, there we have it.
That's pretty cool. Well, what's really interesting is that other people in this organization found me objectionable, and I couldn't take it anymore. And I had to leave. And I left because you're asking me to do something, to use your term, I couldn't feel good about myself. They weren't asking me to commit a crime or anything like that. It's just like, this isn't me anymore. You're asking me to not be me. I'm assertive and not objectionable. And a lot of people actually tell me something like that. That particular phraseology I really like. So there was that. And then there have been other situations, family situations, where I just can't do this. It's like I have to turn myself into a pretzel and I can't be even close to Henry. And I would do it for time and time again because I'm trying to be tolerant and accepting and, you know, and finally it's like, it's not me. I lost myself. It's not, I'm not me anymore, you know? And so again, I called up a friend who said, yeah, but who says you have to keep on doing that? Well, because, says who? Mm-hmm. You know, you're not going to kill somebody. You're just saying, okay, if I can't be me, then I guess we can't be with each other, I guess, regularly.
Or not be with each other in this way. It's not always an all or nothing, which is good to remember. Occasionally, but very occasionally, it is an all or nothing. But if you're inclined towards an all or nothing, I always encourage people to get some serious counsel from somewhere before engaging in all or nothing. Sometimes it is the choice, but not always as often as we want to choose it. And so sometimes the most self-honoring thing is to find some sort of places where we can connect in from who we naturally are, or as close to that as we can get. Because remember, since perfection is not part of the human design plan, we will also not perfectly be who we are all the time either. And we can give ourselves some grace about that. Right. This involves creativity. Life is a creative process, and to find our ways in interaction with other people to be who we are requires some creativity, requires some courage. It really requires us to say, I'm going to surrender to creation and to who nature, God, universe, whoever it might be, who made me, that they knew what the heck they were doing. And I'm going to try to work with that because it just makes sense that that's when we will be our happiest and can innately know we're fulfilling our purpose.
I think doing that for other people is one of the greatest gifts that we can do. Empowering other people to be themselves and accepting them and helping them blossom that way. Yeah, I think if we could think of that, like the quote you mentioned earlier, that's what we can do as parents, as teachers, as therapists, or just as friends. Yeah. So that's a wonderful perspective to have. So we're going to have to stop, which means that you and I are going to have to connect some other time.
Yes. Because, I'll look forward to that.
Yeah, I will too. I want to thank you again. So again, your book, which doesn't have a publication date yet, correct?
Correct, because I have to get over some of my own stuff to get to that point. Right. I'm almost to that, but not quite.
So nourishing your natural self, embodying who you naturally are in a life that is truly yours. So look for it, and maybe we can continue this discussion another time.
I would love to. Yes. And before I say goodbye,
yes,
in case not everyone has heard this, I really want to do for you what my yoga teacher did for me years ago and just say, you are enough. And I really appreciate your time today and participation. Thank you. And thank you, Henry, for having me.
You're welcome. We'll see you again and talk to you soon. Thank you, everyone.
If you find yourself enjoying our podcasts, please do us a favor and spread the word. Tell a friend about it. Give us a review on iTunes or post it on social media. If you or someone you know would like to participate in a future podcast, please connect with us through the Contact Us page. See our events calendar page for dates to our next live podcast recordings. We'd love for you to participate and ask questions. And be sure to check out Joel Lessie's podcast, Unraveling Religion, on your favorite podcast app. Alchemical Dialogues are live and unscripted conversations recorded on Zoom, brought to you by the great folks of Amber Light International, a nonprofit organization co-founded by Henry Curtella, MD, and Kathleen Fitzpatrick, LCSW. We choose topics from our current social and cultural climate with an emphasis on humanism and spirituality.